Hello, everyone, and thanks for turning on The Blender, the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I'm Daisy Sindelar, a writer at RFERL, and I'll be your host this week. Coming up in episode 24 of The Blender, as opposition demonstrations continue in Syria, we speak to one protester who's paid a painful price for standing up to the state.
If we said that we need freedom, they began to kill us. They killed my brother. They killed my brother's friends.
We also look at the recent death of Soviet-era dissident Yelena Bonner and ask whether a new generation of Russian activists are ready to take her place.
I see a future forces possibly very powerful in Russian politics, in ecological movement and in social movement.
But we'll begin by turning to Pakistan, whose complex relationship with the United States has taken on even more twists since the killing last month of al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden. For more on the subject, RFE correspondent Ron Sinovitz spoke to Sebastian Gorka, a military affairs analyst based in Washington, who also serves as an advisor to the United States and its NATO allies.
Why don't we start with the Osama bin Laden raid? Pakistan has arrested Pakistani informants who had been giving information to the United States. What does it say to you that Pakistan, instead of hunting down the people that may have been responsible for sheltering Osama bin Laden in Pakistan, they're instead hunting down the informants?
I think this is a wonderful example of why one cannot talk of Pakistan as a unitary nation. After bin Laden was killed, the immediate question one heard on the American media and internationally was, clearly Pakistan must have known, or if Pakistan didn't know, they were incompetent. This is a misunderstanding of the reality that is today's Pakistan. There is no one political elite in Pakistan. You can quite easily imagine that the political leadership, the civilian leadership in Islamabad, had no idea that bin Laden was living in Abbottabad. But at the same time, you could imagine, for example, that the ISI or that members of the military were well aware of it because, let's be honest, he was within a block and a half of the equivalent of the West Point for Pakistan. So here, I think what we're seeing is perhaps one of these sub-actors inside Pakistan trying to divert attention consciously. Perhaps one of those groups that knows they may be in trouble if the civilian leadership investigates bin Laden's being in Pakistan, and instead of hunting down those people who facilitated his stay in Abbottabad, they are trying to push and divert attention away from themselves.
In interviews that Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty has done with United States lawmakers, one of the signals that we get, rather an underlying tone or suggestion, is that somebody in Pakistan knew perhaps elements within the military or the intelligence services.
The military has to be understood to be a world unto itself in Pakistan. If you walk onto a military base, if you see how people are housed, if you see the quality of living, the quality of just basic food supplies amongst the military families, you understand that there is a real catch-22 situation. On the one hand, the Pakistan military is truly driven by the concept of having to fight another war against India. At the same time, they understand that they are receiving huge amounts of financial and military support from the United States, which guarantee very much not just their national security capacity, but also the lifestyle to which they have become accustomed. Secondly, there is this very influential substratum of doctrinal thought that because war with India drives the strategic culture of the Pakistani military, Afghanistan is seen as a rearguard territory where the forces of Pakistan can retreat to should there be a war with India. On top of that, because India is so much larger, so much more capable and has more nuclear weapons, Pakistan has a very interesting, to say the least, attitude to the use of proxy forces. I have been in debate on Pakistani television with senior Pakistani generals, retired generals, who said there is absolutely no problem with creating, maintaining and utilizing proxy insurgent forces on your own territory. Could you imagine any NATO nation maintaining irregular, non-government insurgent forces on their own territory just in case they had to go to war with a neighbor? This is not how we understand a military strategy. And I think this is one of perhaps the reasons that influenced the decision for some people to provide succor and harbor to bin Laden on the soil of Pakistan.
A Pakistani army major was one of the five who was arrested. This Pakistani army major had been observing and taking license plate numbers of cars going in and out of Osama bin Laden's compound. Does it suggest to you some kind of a cover-up by Pakistan's military?
Possibly. We seem to have confirmed by various sources in the open source unclassified domain that the U.S. intelligence community had assets on the ground for a matter of months surveilling bin Laden's house. So perhaps there wasn't even a need for local sources to do surveillance. Perhaps there was. But again, we enter this twilight zone, this Alice in Wonderland reality of Pakistan-U.S. relations. The fact is, on numerous operations in the last 9 years, Pakistan has provided intelligence to the United States, and the United States has provided intelligence to Pakistan when it is deemed to be of mutual interest. So perhaps in this case, we just have a poor soul who has been in the wrong place at the wrong time and who has been identified as a potential scapegoat. But let's wait and see what happens and who they arraign in a hearing, if there is ever an open hearing in Pakistan after these arrests.
And we should remember that it's Pakistan's military that has arrested.
Yes, I think this is an important point.
It's been reported that another one of the five arrested was the man who owned the property that the CIA was using as a safe house next to Osama bin Laden's compound.
Well, if that's true, that's very unfortunate. If that is the case, then this is clearly a message that Pakistan is sending to America, that yes, you got bin Laden, but we have ways to get back at you. So I think if that turns out to be true, that's not a good sign.
That was military expert Sebastian Gorka speaking to correspondent Ron Sinovitz on the mutual mistrust in the U.S.-Pakistani relationship following the killing of Osama bin Laden. For the full interview, you can visit our website at rferl.org. Now to Syria, where Arab Spring protests have met with a brutal backlash from the government of President Bashar al-Assad. Well over 1,000 people have died since the protests began in March. RFE correspondent Kristen Deasy spoke to one activist who's already paid a harrowing price for standing up to the regime, but says he won't give up. We voiced over parts of the interview because of the poor quality of the phone line from Syria.
When 31-year-old Abdullah decided to take his 19-year-old brother to April's Friday of Rage protest in the southern Syrian city of Daraa, their mother was dismayed. The young men were hoping to deliver supplies to the city, which was under siege by government troops. Abdullah, who asked that his real name not be used, says his younger brother was determined to help.
My brother, when he went to the last protest, he kissed my mother's hand. He told her, "Just don't be angry with me. I'm going to protest." She told him, "May God help you."
But the demonstrations in Daraa quickly turned violent. Government troops fired on protesters, killing at least 16 people and arresting scores more, including Abdullah's brother. Abdullah received no news of his brother until 2 weeks later, when his mutilated body was returned to his family. The teenager's neck had been broken, with drill marks puncturing his skull and hands. There were signs he had been sexually assaulted with an electrical device. The family was devastated. But 2 months later, Abdullah says the tragedy has only strengthened his resolve to stick with protests until Syrian President Bashar al-Assad is ousted.
If we said that we need freedom, they begin to kill us.
If we say that we need freedom, they began to kill us. They killed my brother. They killed my brother's friends. They said that they had guns. They were 19 years old. They don't know how to use a gun. They don't have any guns they could use. Assad says it's just criminals who are activating the people against the system. That's not correct. It is the system that's killing people.
Human rights activists say more than 1,400 people have been killed and some 10,000 arrested since protests began in Syria 3 months ago. The demonstrations took their cue from similar uprisings in Tunisia and Egypt, which led to the overthrow of those countries' autocratic regimes. But Assad, who together with his father has ruled Syria for 4 decades, has shown no sign of giving up. The embattled president offered vague promises of reform in a speech in Damascus earlier this week. But critics dismissed his remarks as meaningless, and the speech was quickly followed by a fresh round of violence in which 7 people were killed, including a 13-year-old boy. Meanwhile, international aid organizations have warned that a humanitarian crisis is brewing in the country. More than 10,000 Syrian refugees have flooded into Turkey to escape the violence. Abdullah, a farmer, has 2 small children and a young wife. He need only think of his brother to understand the risk he takes every time he participates in a new protest. But he refuses to abandon his country's call for a better life. "If we die," he says, "we will die standing."
That was Kristen Deasy on the personal sacrifice suffered by 1 opposition activist in Syria. Just a reminder that The Blender is the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe. RFE brings radio, internet, and television news programming to 21 countries across the former Soviet Union, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, Iraq, and the Balkans. If you'd like to get in touch, it's very, very easy. Drop us a line at podcast@rferl.org or leave a comment on the Blender section of our website. And remember, you can download episodes of The Blender from our website or by subscribing on iTunes. A new episode is posted every Friday. And now for the segment we call Uncovered, a look at some of the under-the-radar stories coming out of RFE's 20 regional bureaus. Editors Merhat Sharabjan and Pete Baumgartner joined me in the studio to help uncover some of these underreported stories. Earlier today, before we came into the studio, we were talking about how unrelentingly grim the news has been lately. So as a favor to me, the stories you've selected for this week, Pete and Merhat, while not entirely lighthearted, at the very least aren't meant to drive us any deeper into despair. So, Pete, you've got a story from our Iraqi service on a plan by the government to transform some of Saddam Hussein's most lavish palaces into tourist facilities and museums.
Iraq's government has decided to take these palaces and to use them as tourist resorts, museums, and galleries. It's something they're going to do because they're receiving these 9 palaces from U.S. forces who have been using them since they invaded Iraq in 2003.
What kind of visitors are they expecting to attract?
Well, they're hoping that this will generate domestic interest in coming to visit the palaces, the former palaces. And they also are hoping, actually, that it will bring people from outside of Iraq to visit the country and to come stay in these former palaces of Saddam Hussein. And it's interesting because these were the private reserve of Hussein and his cronies and his family members, so the people never had a chance to see them or even probably didn't even know that many of them existed.
And you mentioned that they're talking about 9 palaces in particular, but how many palaces are there altogether?
There are a total of 65 presidential palaces that were used by Saddam Hussein. That includes mansions and villas throughout the country.
So potentially some more of these buildings are going to be opened up in the future?
I would think so, yes.
Okay, thank you. And from there, we're going to move to you, Merhat, and to Tajikistan.
That's right. Well, in Tajikistan last week, the lower chamber of the parliament approved a law proposed by President Emomali Rahmon that prohibits presence of children or youngsters, teenagers younger than 18, in the country's mosques. The leading religious cleric Prajan Zada criticized that move, saying that it goes against all the rights of Muslims in the country.
And it apparently any parents who allow these underage children to attend prayers at the mosque are going to
be held
responsible.
Yeah, they will be punished. They'll be responsible, fined, or even face some harsher punishments.
So what's wrong with children attending mosques?
Well, it's clear that the Tajik authorities are concerned that more and more young people are getting influenced by the extremist groups, Islamic fundamentalists, and join the ranks of militants. Last year, for instance, President Rahmon recommended that all the parents whose children are studying abroad at the Islamic universities, especially in Egypt and Iran, should come back to Tajikistan to continue their education home. Again, it was explained by the fact that they might be influenced by the Islamic fundamentalists.
Didn't the Tajik service get a chance to put a question to Rahmon directly last week, asking him, what's the big deal?
Yeah, Rahmon was asked while he was in Austria last week by journalists, why is that? And he just compared that law with a tendency in the western part of the world, which, I mean, the laws in the western part of the law, the regulations prohibiting drinking for youngsters and teenagers, comparing religious issues with the upbringing of the young generation.
So religion is truly the opium of the masses?
It looks like. Looks like.
Okay, thanks very much, Merhat. And Pete, now we're going to turn to one of my favorite historic disputes, the never-ending battle between Greece and Macedonia. Can you explain?
Yeah, the Greek government was angered this week by its northern neighbor, Macedonia, when they erected a huge bronze statue of Alexander the Great in a downtown square in the capital, Skopje. The name of the statue is actually called a warrior on a horse, but it looks very much like Alexander the Great.
So building a statue of an unnamed warrior that just looks like Alexander the Great is enough to make Greece angry, but maybe that's because this isn't the first time that something like this has happened.
No, this really goes back to 1993, if not earlier, when Macedonia, after the breakup of Yugoslavia, Macedonia joined the UN and they were forced to take the name the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia instead of just calling themselves Republic of Macedonia, which is what they wanted. And Greece has also blocked Macedonia most recently from joining NATO 2 years ago because of this dispute.
So this is a dispute that is not only longstanding, but it comes at a huge cost to Macedonia, and it comes at a huge financial cost as well, doesn't it? How much is the warrior on a horse costing them?
It is said to have cost 5.3 million euros, which is a huge sum for a country that is by most standards, relatively poor.
It's also a strange thing for Greece to be worried about at a time like this. It's almost as though they have nothing else on their minds. We will move to our last story. And just as many people save the best part of the newspaper, the crossword puzzle, for last, our last story is about a crossword puzzle. Merhat.
Yeah, the crossword puzzle scandal, I would say, erupted in North Kazakhstan, in the city of Kokshetau. In May, the crossword puzzle carried a question saying, what is the dwelling of a Kazakh street bum? And the answer, the right answer, was shown as yurt, a traditional mobile house of nomadic nations of Eurasia, including Kazakhs. Several movements in Kazakhstan demanded punishment for the newspaper, demanded closure of the newspaper, and last week also the parliament member, Onurbaev, also said that he demanded from the government to consider the possible closure of the newspaper. The newspaper's chief editor already apologized several times, said to RFL that the crossword puzzle was borrowed by some foreign periodical, and he was very sorry that it was by mistake printed there. But this is a big issue in Kazakhstan today, especially in the parts of Kazakhstan where Russians are dominantly living in big cities.
Is this a slur against people who live in yurts, or is this a more general slur against Kazakhs?
I think the word used there in the question was bomj in Russian, meaning it's abbreviation of the Soviet era definition of the homeless people, which became a kind of a curse word. And Kazakhs and the movements and officials are very angry that that word was used defining or depicting Kazakhs in the question. Not so much about yurt, but yurt also was the issue there, but mainly why Kazakhs were kind of associated with homeless street bums.
Okay, thank you so much, Pete, Merhat. Interesting stories, as always.
Thank you very much.
говорить радіо Свобода.
Радіо Фарда гуш میکنی.
Машал радіо Дамінія
Азатсун ДТМ.
Радіо Азат. 28 languages, 21 countries, one voice. Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty.
And finally, we look at the legacy of Yelena Bonner. The Soviet-era Russian dissident died on June 18th at the age of 88 at her home in Boston. Her lifetime spanned everything from the Stalinist repressions to the Soviet collapse and the rise of Vladimir Putin. Together with her husband, Nobel Peace Prize laureate Andrei Sakharov, she became one of the leading moral voices to speak out against the crimes of the communist era and beyond. Kirill Kobrin, the managing editor of RFE's Russian service, joined Brian Whitmore, the author of our Power Vertical blog and the host of the Power Vertical podcast, to talk about Bonner's legacy at a time when the need for activism is as great as ever in Russia.
Kirill, the first thing that came to my mind after learning the sad news of Yelena Bonner's death last weekend, that this is truly the end of an era. I mean, this is an overused cliche, but in this case, I think it really, really applies. And by that, I mean, it's going to be very, very difficult to replicate the moral force of Yelena Bonner's generation of dissidents.
The idea of moral judgment from some public figure is nearly disappeared in modern Russia. Andrei Dmitriyevich Sakharov, he was the first iconic figure in dissident movement in Soviet Union. And I think he is the first iconic figure in the dissident movement all over the world. To be a dissident now, today, in post-war world, it's not just about that you are opposing some bad guys in totalitarian system or so whatever. You have to do something with so-called public relations, because you are relating to the society, to the public. Mm-hmm. And returning to the figure of Yelena Bonner, she was some kind of public relations specialist by Andrei Sakharov. If you are opposing some kind of totalitarian system, which has a total control over media and so on, you have to invent your own media.
Yeah, and they did that with yes. press and conferences in their apartments.
And she did this. That is the great importance of her activity during 1970s and 1980s.
One of the things when I listened to Vladimir Sinelnikov's interview with Bonner, which is the last video interview she gave, one of the things that struck me the most was how forward-looking she was. She seemed much more interested in talking about the future of Russia than reflecting on her past. Let's listen to one segment of that interview that we picked out.
Today, it is a crime to be silent, and I find it is a strategic mistake that the opposition is divided into so many different parties. Today, as dreadful as it sounds, there needs to be a unification of all the opposition forces in the country as a whole. Leaders are not born from the writings of Dmitry Bykov or Garry Kasparov. Leaders are born right here in the thick of things. Either we will just soil everything, or we will save Russia.
Well, what about that? I mean, she seems to be saying here one of the biggest problems is the divisions. Russia's, I don't ever remember a time in my life, I don't know if you remember a time when the Russian opposition was not divided, but is she onto something here? Is this the biggest problem that's facing the opposition right now?
I think that this division between the various opposition forces and so on, it's not just a bad will of leaders of this opposition. There are a lot of various groups and interests inside the opposition, and there are some liberals, there are some social democrats, or liberal social democrats like Yabloko. There are some ultra-liberal forces there, like Mikhail Kasyanov's movement and so on.
There's nationalists like Limonov.
Yes, not nationalists, but some kind of radicals. Mm-hmm. It's not surprising that this division exists. The only platform or only base for this united opposition is that all of them, they hate Putin's regime. it's a very poor foundation for a real opposition movement. I think the future with the Russian democratic movement, as any other grassroots movements, they are, first of all, in Russian province. It's not just about Moscow.
Mm-hmm.
Real opposition will be in Russian province and based on a real social and economic interests of people. It's not about playing some games with the police during the Moscow demonstrations.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's about a real life, real politics. It's about real life.
Do you see anybody out there, and this maybe is not a fair question to ask, but do you see anybody out there that could take the mantle that Yelena Bonner and Andrei Sakharov took in their time?
The main idea of Russian of Soviet dissident movement was that they supported the idea of human rights. Yes, it was not about to throw out Soviet system and so on. It was about the human rights and to follow the existing Russian or Soviet constitution. Today, constitution, for instance, is not bad. If the government, yes, if they will play government, play authorities, play a fair play with this, everything will be okay. So this is one of the reasons, I think, for reinventing of this human rights movement.
Let's just obey our own laws.
Yes. Because
that was Andrei Sakharov and Yelena Bonner's, their mantra in their time was let's obey our own laws.
Yes, that's why I think that this part of Soviet movement, the dissident movement, is very important today. I see a future forces possibly very powerful in Russian politics, in ecological movement and in social movements.
One of the things that did make Yelena Bonner and Andrei Sakharov so effective as dissidents was that they were not professional opposition people, right? They had lives and jobs, and they were drawn into this because they didn't like the way things were going, but they were not the professional opposition that we see now. And we're seeing in recent years this movement of ordinary people suddenly moving into opposition activities because of events that affected their lives, whether it's the Himki Forest or the Blue Buckets or what have you. You're seeing a lot more of these just ordinary people, and maybe somebody will rise out of one of these movements.
Andrei Sakharov wasn't just the first iconic dissident, as we told. He was the first real dissident from not the humanitarian sphere. He was not writer. He was physicist. He was a prominent scientist with a well-known name and so on. And he was speaking outside this humanitarian context, cultural context, yes, like some kind of outsider with just a common sense.
Mm-hmm.
Because this idea, just obey their own laws, it's the idea of common sense. Mm-hmm. If you have laws, we will have to obey them.
I want to listen now to one other excerpt from the interview Yelena Bonner gave, where she takes a fairly dark take on the current state of Russian politics. And let's listen to that now.
Стране нужна нормальная
The country needs a normal democratic system of elections. And even the system that Anatoly Lukyanov and Mikhail Gorbachev once came up with was much closer to a democracy than what Vladimir Churov and the company have done with the election law. That law simply destroyed everything. The issue isn't administrative resources or fake ballots. The problem is that the very structure has been destroyed, and there is no feedback. No elected individual is accountable to those who supposedly elected him. There is no feedback. The country is not just non-democratic. It's not even autocratic. It's simply despotism.
That's a very, very dark vision. Now, you lived in the Soviet Union during the Perestroika era. In fact, you're from Gorky, what is today Nizhny Novgorod, and you lived there when Sakharov and Yelena Bonner were there in exile.
Yeah.
What do you think of this sentiment? She's saying basically that Russia, or the Soviet Union in the Gorbachev period, was more democratic than Russia today. I have some thoughts on that myself, but I'd like to hear yours.
In some populist sense, of course, it during Perestroika, Russia or Soviet Union was much more democratic than now. But just in a populist sense of the or meaning of the word democratic. Of course, today's electoral law is much more formally, much more democratic than this one, which had been invented or made by Gorbachev and Lukyanov.
Which preserved the Communist Party's monopoly of power, basically.
Yes. I think that the message, Yelena Bonner's message, is not just about the system, but she told about the system. It's about the practice. Mm-hmm. Political practicizing of this law, which became a system.
Yes. You don't have an Article 6 of the Soviet Constitution which preserves the Communist Party's monopoly on power. What you do have is an understanding that United Russia is going to have, if not a majority, maybe a constitutional majority in every Duma.
Right. With other means, just with other
without
means,
any,
yes,
yeah,
yeah, and that's why we are speaking about that the laws in modern Russia, they are not very bad, they are pretty good in some senses, they're pretty good, but the authorities don't want to obey, for instance, this electoral law. First of all, they didn't want just to registrate this opposition Democratic Party Parnas.
Right.
But don't forget that it's a marginal group.
Yeah.
They afraid of even the marginal group, opposition group.
They're afraid of anything they can't control.
Yes.
And the other thing I would add is that in the late 80s and early 90s, maybe it was less democratic in a formal sense than today, but the direction things were going was undoubtedly toward a more democratic direction, where today that does not appear to be the case.
It's a very important thing because there was a kind of image of a future.
Yeah.
And now the population of Russia and Russian society, they don't have this image.
Yeah.
We're asking them, what do you think about the future, not of yourself, but the future of your own country?
Right.
They can't answer.
The last thing I wanted to mention is, as I mentioned, you're a native of Gorky, which is today Nizhny Novgorod, which is where Yelena Bonner and Andrei Sakharov were in exile. What was it like growing up were people aware that these iconic figures were amongst them? What was the attitude toward them in Gorky?
I was a student at that time, and I never met them, of course. But all of us, students of historical department of Gorky University, we knew that some prominent figure, some academic Sakharov, about whom we heard listening to radio, Radio Svoboda and the BBC. Of course, everyone knew about them. I cannot say that all of us or some of us just agreed with their views.
Were you aware of their views?
Those who listened to Radio Svoboda and BBC Russian service, yes, of course, we knew everything about it. We heard about some terrible stories about the treatment they had in Gorky Hospital. It's a famous story, and so on. But we couldn't decide anything. We couldn't just to choose the side in this in this struggle. Then, in the middle of 1980s, there was already another time. But in the very beginning, before Brezhnev's death and so on, it was another story. Mm-hmm. All of us, we were absolutely sure that we will die in Soviet Union, that Soviet Union is forever.
That was Brian Whitmore and Kirill Kobrin talking about the legacy of Russian activist Yelena Bonner. The full video interview with Bonner is available on our website at rferl.org. And that's all we've got time for this week. Thanks to producer Tanya Kancheva for her help in whipping up another episode of The Blender. And thanks to you for turning on The Blender. I'm Daisy Sindelar, and we're taking you out with a recording by one of Yelena Bonner's closest friends, the legendary cellist Mstislav Rostropovich. This is the prelude from Bach's Cello Suite, number 1 in G major, which Rostropovich famously performed at the fall of the Berlin Wall in November 1989. We'll see you next week.
Mm-hmm.